This is The Guardian.
Because of industrial action taking place by members of the National Union of Journalists at The Guardian and Observer this week, you may notice some disruption to the availability of new episodes in your Guardian podcast feeds in the coming days. All the work on this episode was done before the strike action began. For more information, please head to theguardian.com.
The fall of the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad has been celebrated around the world.
It's an indescribable joy to see your country of origin to be liberated in the way that it's been liberated.
But as talk turns to the country's future, what next for the millions of Syrians who fled his brutal regime and the thousands who settled here in the UK?
People wish to go home. We'd certainly like to facilitate that. But I think it's too early to say.
And having insisted that austerity is over, Rachel Reeves has been trailing her grim-looking spending review and sparking one big question. Is there anything left for the government to cut? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Weekly UK for The Guardian. Over the last week, you won't have missed the incredible images of people celebrating the fall of the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad, who fled to Moscow. Where else? Assad ruled the country for over two decades, and during that time, millions of Syrians were displaced, with many settling in the UK and other countries. Razan al-Sous is originally from Syria and came to the UK 12 years ago with her three young children and husband. She settled in Yorkshire, where she started Dama Cheese, a company that has won numerous awards. Hi, Razan. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Nice to see you here as well.
And you. Right. Tell me, first of all, how you have felt watching this news unfold.
Well, first of all, definitely, we couldn't believe that this is could happen. However, when we've seen the news that he just fled Syria, he just left it, we were so happy. It's amazing that finally, can we really feel this freedom? It's unbelievable, to be honest. Definitely, who doesn't like freedom?
You say freedom, but also the country is in a chaotic state at the moment. That's inevitably the case. The economy has collapsed.
Yeah.
And maybe in certain respects, it's not entirely clear who's in charge, right? How do you feel about that? And also, Israel's attacked Syria recently,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So there's a lot to worry about, is there, at the same time?
There are a lot to worry about, definitely. But they've been ruling Syria for more than 50 years. And we didn't even had the chance to live. Or like he didn't even let any other countries being like becoming friends with us. Like Syrian around the world, it wasn't a good thing to say you are from Syria. Now, it's chaotic. Yes, I'm talking to my family in Syria every day. And so far, they are saying everything seems going on the right direction.
So, I was going to ask you that. Hold on.
1 minute.
Was that your family phoning up?
My phone. I will just take it. Yeah. Today, last thing, I was talking to my uncle and asked him how is everything. He told me around 60 to 70% life is going back to normality. He told me we would feel more comfortable on Saturday. The schools will reopen again. And he said this is a really good sign when we see the children going back to school. And today in the afternoon, we've seen an announcement that the restriction on going out as a lockdown being eased on Damascus. So there's no restriction from going out anymore, which is good.
Yeah, right. Let's go back a bit in your life. Tell me about coming to the UK and why you left Syria yourself.
So basically, we came to the UK because of the war. When everything started, we stayed in Damascus. But we made a decision when an explosion happened at my husband's office. So we've got three children. At that time, it was horrible, as you would be killed. Maybe because of where are you from? We are not in politics. We are just normal people who lived, had a business, and thinking of our children's future, as simple as this.
And when was it that you left? What year did you leave?
2012.
Okay. Here's a question about your life when you were in Syria. We all know and we've known for many, many years about how vicious the Assad regime was, right?
Yep.
And we're now seeing evidence of that in very vivid stories, for example, about the emptying out of prisons, people being released from prison, and they're finding people, the most horrific things, people who've been locked in the dark for decades, they're finding children in prisons and so on. When you were in Syria, presumably people knew about those things and they were talked about. Is that right?
Not at this extent, to be honest. Until today, we can't believe how bad that was.
So most people had no idea about the awfulness of what was going on in those prisons.
We know it's awful. We know it's awful. We know it's not a good thing to be against the Assad regime. We know that you might disappear, but we never thought it will be at that extent with inhumanity. What we've seen, it's beyond our imagination. It's even for those whom been released from prison, they wouldn't be able to tell the full story because they will be back.
Yeah, yeah. You'd be too scared, right?
This is why everyone been really scared of just approach, because we know that people might disappear without any details.
So when you first came to the UK, tell me how that was and whether you felt welcomed.
Definitely.
You did.
When we came to the UK, it's like a new life. It's something as you've got another chance of life, because we settled in Huddersfield. And for me and the family, it was a big change between living in Damascus in the capital or living in a village. But I felt the peaceful green areas, the people being very welcoming, very relaxing atmosphere. The first thing, you feel confused. You feel that you've got value, you've got people are respecting you. I would say respect is the most important thing. And the regime always used to show us that the West are enemies. We found that's not correct, because people welcomed us, loved us, especially when I started to think of making a business. Everyone supported me. Now, 99.9% from our customers whom buying our cheese are British people. So I felt I'm really welcome.
Yeah, yeah. Before we started talking, one of your kids helped you out with their headphones, and it was very noticeable they have a Yorkshire accent. I noticed that straight away. Your business is based here, as you say. It's been very successful. Your kids, as I've just mentioned, have grown up here, right?
Yeah.
And I guess Yorkshire and the UK are part of your kids' identity now, right?
Definitely.
Does the UK feel like home? I would imagine it does.
Definitely. Right. Even if you ask my children, where are you from? They would say from Huddersfield.
Yes. I'm sure you don't have any sort of firm sense of when, but you must be thinking about sooner or later at least visiting Syria again for the first time.
Sure.
How do you feel about that prospect?
So excited, actually. For me, I left my home with all my memories. During this 13 years, I couldn't even put this file again in my head and start to think about it or talk about these memories. Because when we left, you had two options, either to regret and start to remember or to feel, why am I in here, and feel down. Or you have another option, is to look at the future. And this is what I've done. I looked at the future because we thought, we've got children and we are in a bad situation, how to get out of it. But now, after everything, or after the collapse of the regime, I feel I want to go. I want to see my home. I want to tell my children all the stories, all the memories we made it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I would love to show them, where are we from? What is Damascus? It's the civilization, show them the family, introduce them to their family. They can't believe that they've got a very big family. They think that people usually got only mom, dad, uncle and auntie, but we've got really big family there.
This is very powerful, isn't it? It doesn't get much more emotional than this. This is the absolute sort of most important parts of who we are and how we feel about where we live and the people that we are and our family and all of that.
Definitely, definitely.
Thank you so much for joining us, Razan.
Thank you very much. No problem.
Thank you. I'm now joined by The Guardian's political correspondent, Kieran Stacey. Hi, Kieran.
Hey, John.
The government has paused its consideration of thousands of asylum claims from Syrian people. It's a big move. That, let's have a listen to the Border Security and Asylum Minister, Angela Eagle.
We'll have to wait to see what happens. We have suspended our consideration of the current asylum claims, about 6,500, until we can see what emerges from the current situation. If people wish to go home, we'd certainly like to facilitate that. But I think it's too early to say.
Kieran, give me a bit of context here. There are comparable moves, as we all know, happening in other European countries. Angela Eagle has also said she'd like to facilitate Syrian people, by which she presumably means people granted leave to remain, returning home. What are you hearing from the Home Office about all this?
Well, I think what the Home Office would love in this situation is for Syria to be secure enough and open enough for a lot of those people who came over, you know, really over the last 10, 15 years to go back home. And clearly that's what a lot of people would like to do. But the fact is, we just don't know. We don't really know who's in charge in Syria right now. And we don't know what kind of regime they're going to operate. So I think what the government did very early on, as you say, in conjunction with other European countries, was just to say, look, we don't quite know whether people are going to be able to go home yet, but we also can't really rule on the existing claims because we don't know whether their country is safe or not.
Yeah, although there is a sort of uneasy and uglier dimension to this potentially, isn't there, which is about what might happen to Syrian people who came over 5, 10, 15 years ago and have made their homes and lives here. Given the sort of toxicity around a lot of the debate, so-called debate and rhetoric about immigration, those people understandably are feeling concerned.
Yeah, well, I guess they're probably feeling more concerned at the moment about what's happening in Syria. But it was interesting, I think, that very quickly the political consensus over what's happening in Syria started to deteriorate, even in the first few days after the overthrow of Assad. Because while the government here was saying, right, we need to pause asylum claims and, you know, see what the situation is on the ground before we make any further decisions, Robert Jenrick, the shadow justice secretary, was out there quickly saying, oh, well, now must be the time for lots of Syrians to go home. So you can see the beginnings of a split there between Labour and the Tory party. And you can imagine that if there are more signs that Syria might be settling down, that the Tories are going to go in quite hard on A, let's deny these people asylum, and B, let's start sending people home.
Yeah, not like Robert Jenrick to make such noises at all, is it?
It's part of his brand.
Yes, he's still in his buzz cut phase. Obviously, that's going to be ongoing. That sort of is part of a bigger conversation about the politics of all this. With a grim inevitability, Nigel Farage is making a lot of noise about dangerous people now leaving Syria, given that prisons there are being emptied and so on. So inevitably, when you get these flare-ups that involve questions about asylum and immigration and shifts of policy, they then get thrown into this horrible, poisonous sort of rhetorical soup and carry on simmering away. I wonder, to what extent do you think the government is worried about all that? You've mentioned Jenrick, I've mentioned Farage. Those sorts of noises usually make the Labour Party feel very nervous.
Yeah, they do. And actually, I would say it's not just rhetoric on this occasion. I think the government has reason to be nervous because of part of what Nigel Farage is saying has some validity. There are camps in the north of Syria, which are under Kurdish control, where a lot of Brits who went to join Islamist groups and fight out there are currently being held. And I think there is genuine concern, actually, about what happens if the Kurds lose control of those camps.
Right.
Now, what we're told at the moment is that there are no indications that the Kurds have lost control. They are warning the Kurds that ISIS is trying to stage a resurgence, and they said there has been an unsuccessful breakout attempt at the camp where Shamima Begum, who, of course, departed the UK when she was just a teenager, where she is being held. But at the moment, they say the security situation is holding. I think the nightmare situation here for the government is that the security situation deteriorates to the extent that we don't know where some of those Brits are. Could they be trying to return to the UK? We just don't know. And then I think the kind of panic and the political ramifications will come after that.
And they will be felt in two government departments. One is the Home Office that we've talked about briefly. The other is the Foreign Office. Give me a sense of the Foreign Office's sort of collective institutional sense at the moment about the situation in Syria, the chaos there, which is now compounded, as we know, by attacks launched on Syria by Israel, and where the Foreign Office might be on anxieties about the unravelling of the Middle East, the ongoing unravelling of the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are probably a number of instincts going on within the British government at the moment. The first is just, my goodness, let's just wait and see before taking any serious decisions here. I thought it was really interesting earlier this week that Pat McFadden, the Cabinet Office Minister, came out on the airwaves and suggested that there might be some kind of deprescription of HTS, this rebel group that has been at the forefront of the coup in Syria. From the people I talked to, they really don't want to go there because, not least, they don't actually know that HTS is actually in control there or will be in control for any length of time. So what they don't want to do is jump into some decision about, right, okay, this is now no longer a terrorist group, and then find that they're, you know, they've promised to do business with a group that's not in control and actually is you know, a harmful presence on the ground in Syria. The other thing I think that's at the play for the Foreign Office in particular is a desire for the Brits not to really be seen to be intervening in this conflict in any way. I think it would be disastrous if one side or another was seen to have Western backing. And the Brits are very aware of that. And so want to make sure that at no point does any minister say anything that looks like it's trying to tilt the balance one way or another. But of course, I should say, the bigger consideration here is, of course, what the Americans will do. And I think the large decisions on things like whether we deprescribe HTS will kind of be made in Washington and will end up following suit.
Yeah, of course. And that then brings us into the question of the Trump administration taking the reins in the new year and what that will mean for that region and so on, which no doubt we'll discuss then. Anyway, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be looking at the slightly more parochial matter of Rachel Reeves's call for Whitehall to somehow tighten its belt. Welcome back. Kieran Stacey, The Guardian's political correspondent, is still with me. This week has seen the return of a story that first stirred a few months ago. Rachel Reeves has launched her crackdown on government waste, in quote marks, asking every cabinet minister to somehow find 5% efficiency cuts, I think we can put those in quote marks as well, in their budgets. It seems that tens of thousands... You're laughing, Kieran.
I am. I'm sorry, that 5% number.
If I was a civil servant, I wouldn't be laughing. if I was a so-called service user, I'm not sure I'd be laughing either, and I'm definitely one of those. But anyway, it seems that tens of thousands of civil service jobs will be cut. The government, meanwhile, says it wants Whitehall to start running itself more like a startup. First of all, just clarify what Rachel Reeves is asking for. I first read about 5% efficiency cuts months ago, didn't I? This is a sort of old and yet new story in some respects.
It is a figure that is trotted out by every single chancellor going into a spending review. And it's the kind of start point. You say, right, can you make efficiency savings, quote unquote, of 5%? And then we'll figure out what your final allocation will be, whether it be above that or below that. But basically, we want you to go through everything that you're spending at the moment and figure out what's wasteful, what's not, what you could do more efficiently. Now, I've spent the last 48 hours talking to former Treasury officials, former number 10 officials, people who've worked very closely on these reviews in the past. Pretty much unanimously, they say the 5% figure is made up. It doesn't relate to any particular study of what can actually be achieved. I'll also say that even though they talk about efficiencies, the first thing that Labour said, that Rachel Reeves said when she was unveiling this push, was that they were going to stop a Boris Johnson era programme of putting social workers into schools, which they said was wasting about £60 million a year, which is all very well and good, but it's not efficiencies. They just cut a programme. And that inevitably is what departmental secretaries of state are going to do over the next few months. They're going to go back to the Treasury and say, hey, look, if you want 5%, I'm not sure I can do it with efficiencies, but I could do it by scrapping this program that you really love. So if you want to go there, you can, but you know, I'm not sure you do. And then there's basically a game of chicken between Treasury and Whitehall departments to see who's going to blink first and who's going to back down.
But if we go back only a matter of weeks, the government line was that there wasn't going to be a return to austerity. Now, we know that various pots of money were increased, you know, those for the upgrades of hospitals and schools, for example. A bit of extra money was given to local government. I've just been reading this week the $760 million extra for capital spending on special needs education, right? So that, I guess, those things are why the government thinks it can still credibly insist that austerity is not what it's interested in. But if the demand for 5% cuts across the board, particularly if they end up manifesting themselves in the way that you've talked about, isn't austerity, then what is it? So they've got a problem here in terms of basic coherence, haven't they?
I mean, I'd separate out two things there. One is the 5% efficiency savings, which, as I say, just get asked all the time, every time, no matter whether you're actually planning to increase or decrease Whitehall spending. The second is the reason that people talk about a return to austerity is what Rachel Reeves did at the budget and the kind of mini spending review she held earlier this year was to say, we're going to whack up government budgets, departmental budgets for the next 2 years, and then they have to start coming down. And
yeah.
That's the bit that's going to be really difficult to do. And you mentioned earlier our colleague Rowena Mason has a story in Thursday's paper saying there would be thousands of job cuts in the civil service as a result of that. That is one of the easiest ways to get rid of costs. And that's the kind of thing I think departments will inevitably have to start doing, because they had a big boost of funding for 2 years to get them through some very difficult decisions. But that is going to be chipped away for each of the successive 3 years of this parliament.
And that means, notwithstanding all this talk about making government run like a startup and bringing the genius of the private sector to bear on the machinery of state and so on, surely to God, if you end up cutting the civil service by tens of thousands, that amounts to lots more unanswered calls and the prospect of sort of sclerosis and slowdown in the government machine, right? I mean, that's the risk they're toying with.
Absolutely. I mean, you take capacity out and that is going to have an impact. And in fact, there are some people
who say...
Actually, it will increase costs, because what you end up doing is relying on external consultants to provide the services that you actually really need. There's another thing that might end up happening here, which is something that's happened in the past. If things really get to the crunch and Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer realise that public services are about to fall flat on their faces, what they could do is give certain departments an in-year cash boost to just get them through an NHS winter crisis, for example. This is something that George Osborne started doing after the 2015 election when he promised another round of austerity and then found it wasn't deliverable. But it's an absolutely terrible way to spend money, because if you're doing in-year cash injections, departments can't properly plan for it. They can't hire the staff.
This is what Keir Starmer calls sticking plaster politics.
So I'd be really interested. One of the things I'm going to watch over the next few years is if Rachel Reeves comes out, does a really painful spending review, calls herself the Iron Chancellor, and then, you know, through the back door gives departments in-year bonuses of cash, because that is exactly the kind of sticking plaster politics, as you say, that they promised to get rid of.
This is not fixing the foundations. All those metaphors about going down B&Q and thoroughgoingly setting about making sure your house is sustainable will go out the window once you've adopted that approach.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think on the flip side, they have also whacked up taxes quite a lot and borrowing to the extent that British interest rates have started to go up as well. So they've kind of got all the money coming in, I think, that they can. I don't know what the metaphor is, but they've squeezed every last drop of revenues. But instead of kind of staggering that spending over the five-year period, they just gave everybody an immediate rush of cash to try and deal with some immediate political problems. And then are going to have to deal with the harder stuff, I think, further down the line.
How do you think ministers are reacting to all this behind the scenes?
I think so far, nervously but quietly. We've not had the kind of briefing that we did earlier this year with the smaller spending review, when, of course, three secretaries of state wrote to Keir Starmer to ask him to overrule Rachel Reeves, which, as far as we can tell, he didn't do. One thing I've picked up on is some concern among Whitehall officials that the Treasury is really driving the entire government agenda now. They say that number 10's not really doing very much. Keir Starmer's away the whole time. It's Rachel Reeves who's in charge. And they're worried that if the Chancellor is in charge, the Treasury essentially takes over and cost-cutting becomes the de facto purpose of the government.
Right, okay. Well, that brings me to a sort of a bigger point, I suppose. A bit of cutting honesty here. I am increasingly lost as to what the plan is. And that's partly because we've gone from five missions to six steps and all of that stuff. And I'm lost on that score. But also, this comes down to Rachel Reeves herself. As we both know, in the summer, she sounded sort of grim and penny-pinching. Then she did the budget and she briefly came over sort of expansionist and optimistic. Now we're back to a narrative of tighten your belt and cuts. They're going on and on, the government is, about the machinery of the state and bringing in business minds and so on. That will sound very, very arcane to most people. There's still no obvious, clear sort of stirring story about the basic state of the country, any sort of moral view of things, I suppose, about how the government is or isn't going to make Britain fairer. And increasingly, It feels like quite a cold, mechanistic administration run by cold, mechanistic people. Leaves a big space for raw humanity, and that's one of the reasons perhaps why Nigel Farage's profile has suddenly undergone this, you know, its 96th boost, right? He has those from time to time. And he's in the midst of another one. Again, this is a question about Labour nerves, I suppose. Do you pick up those sorts of worries on the part of Labour politicians that the government hasn't got any story and into the space comes Farage?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that those concerns are there right at the heart of Number 10 as well. They talk quite a lot at the moment about needing to not just improve public services, not just improve the country, but needing to tell a good story about doing so at the same time. The problem is Keir Starmer is not a natural storyteller. So he's
not the
person who can weave this great narrative of what the country is going to look like in 5 years' time. It's just not in his character. Maybe that's fine. Maybe somebody else can do it. But as you say, it's not Rachel Reeves's natural inclination either.
Well, there's two problems there, aren't there? Rachel Reeves isn't a natural storyteller, but also you can come up with the best narrative in the world. But if the Treasury tail is wagging the dog, the Treasury says there's only one story in town, which how much does it cost? And we're not funding it.
I think that's exactly right. They're constantly talking about various different things. You know, one moment the priority is growth, another moment the priority is fairness and higher pay for lower paid workers, another moment the priority is the NHS.
Sunak-esque this is, isn't it, really?
I know. I always thought Starmer and Sunak were quite similar in temperament, and I think we're starting to see that. What I would say is, however, what they're doing that the Tories didn't really do for the last few years is take big decisions. And it's worth looking at what those decisions are. The main one came in the budget, which was, as I think the headline on the front page of The Guardian put it the next day, a return to tax and spend. This is a big taxing, large, heavy borrowing, big spending Labour government. The big gamble here is we need to put more funding into public services to try and keep them running. It's not really one about growth. It's not really something about living standards. It's not
even really one about
immigration. The big decision here that this government has made is put more money in and hope that things actually right themselves.
I can see that, right? So it's sort of meat and potatoes, just left of centre social democracy in that regard. I get that. But the problem is that, to go back to something you said a moment ago, politics is both about what you do and what you say. Yeah. But unfortunately, what you say is probably more important, right? The way things are framed, the account you give of yourselves and what you're doing to the electorate. And on that score, as you've said a few times, they're still lacking. When I was reporting from the Farmers' March a couple of weeks ago, and Farage was there and Clarkson was there, and there was this sort of seditious atmosphere as they all stood opposite Downing Street, you know, howling about the pain that the government was going to put them through, and all the government came out with in response was sort of numbers and statistics. I got a very sharp but sort of inarticulable sense of, hold on, something is stirring here, right? Same feeling I got in the build-up to the Brexit referendum about Farage and the forces that he represents. And I can't make the rational case necessarily, factually, for why it seems like they're about to come over the hill in large numbers. But on a sort of gut level, it feels like that. Do you think, nonetheless, there is a sort of rational, factual story to be told? Something is happening here, isn't it? That politics is really, really shifting all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, just look at the polls. There are some now that put Reform ahead of any other party. So the support is there. It is building. Let's imagine that there's some kind of wave and they end up getting 100 MPs. That presumably then makes it a hung parliament next time around. That's when you maybe start talking about a Reform Conservative coalition government. And by the way, I don't think Labour's blind to this at all. You know, people around Keir Starmer, Morgan McSweeney in particular, is very aware of the fact that Reform poses maybe the biggest risk to Labour at the next election. The problem is, just as you say, that what to do about that. And at the moment, the answer to that is, well, we'll just fix everything and then people will feel better. And I think increasingly they're thinking that's simply not working. That's not going to work. But I don't think it takes much of an intellectual leap to think Reform could be in an enormously powerful electoral position after the next election.
Fascinating. We'll be returning to that time and again. I know you talked about it in Politics Weekly Westminster on Monday, but this is not going to go away. Thank you so much for joining us, Kieran.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. As I always say, if you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Weekly UK wherever you get your podcasts. And please leave us a review. This year, for the Guardian and Observer's annual charity appeal, we're asking for your support to help individuals whose lives have been turned upside down by conflict. We're partnering with War Child and MSF to help support individuals impacted by the horrific effects of war, from emergency aid to psychological support. And we've also teamed up with Parallel Histories, who help schools teach children about contested conflicts. If you can, please donate now at theguardian.com/donate24. I'll be back next week for our final episode of the year and joined by our Politics Weekly Westminster hosts Pippa Creera and Kieran Stacey for a review of 2024. Plus, we'll be taking your questions. So if you want to ask us anything about what the hell just happened or what on earth could happen next, please do send us questions on any of our social media pages. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.